Manfred de la Rey went directly to his office at the end of the corridor after he had left Shaza. His secretary spoke to him as he passed her desk, but he did not seem to hear her. He locked the door to his own office, but did not sit at the massive mahogany desk. He prowled the floor restlessly, his eyes unseeing, and his heavy jaws chewing like a bulldog with a bone. He took the handkerchief from his jacket pocket and wiped his chin, and then paused to examine his face in the wall mirror behind his desk. He was so pale that his cheeks had a bluish sheen, and his eyes were savage as those of a wounded leopard caught in a trap. "White sword," he whispered aloud. It was 25 years since he had used that code name, but he remembered standing on the bridge of the German U-boat, coming in towards the land in darkness, with his hair and great bushy beard dyed black, staring out at the signal fires on the beach where Rolf Stunder waited for him. Rolf Stunder had been with him through all the dangerous days and the wild endeavours. They had planned many of their operations in the kitchen of the Stander cottage in the little village of Stellenbosch. It was there, in that kitchen, that he had given them the details of the action that would be the signal for the glorious uprising of the Afrikaner patriots. And at all those meetings, Sarah Stander had been present. A quiet, unobtrusive presence, serving coffee and food, never speaking, but listening. It was only many years later that Manfred had been able to guess at how well she had listened. In 1948, when the Afrikaners had at last won at the ballot box, the power which they had failed to seize at the point of the sword, Manfred's hard and loyal work had been rewarded with a deputy minister's post in the Department of Justice. One of his first acts had been to send for the files of the unsolved attempt on the life of Jan Smuts and the murder of Sir Garrick Courtney. Before he destroyed the files, he read them through carefully, and he learned that they had been betrayed. There had been a traitor in their gallant band of patriots, a woman who had telephoned the Smuts police officers to warn them of the assassination. He had guessed at the woman's identity, but had never extracted his full retribution, waiting for the moment to ripen, savouring the thought of revenge over the decades, watching the traitor's misery, watching her growing old and bitter, while frustrating her husband's efforts to succeed in law and politics, in the guise of mentor and advisor, steering him into folly and disaster, until Rolf Stunder had lost all his sustenance, his property, and his will to carry on. All that time, Manfred had waited for the perfect moment for the final revenge stroke, and at last it had arrived. Sarah Stunder had come to him to plead for the life of the bastard he had placed in her womb, and he had denied her. The pleasure of it had been exquisite, made more poignant by the years he had waited for it. Now the woman had turned vindictive. He had not anticipated that. He had expected the blow to break and destroy her. Only the greatest good fortune had given him forewarning of this new betrayal she planned. He turned from the mirror and sat down at his desk. He reached determinedly for the telephone and told his secretary, "I want Colonel Bester in the Bureau for State Security." Bester was one of his most trusted officers. "Bester," he barked, "I want a detention order drawn up urgently. I will sign it myself, and I want it executed immediately." "Yes, Minister. Can you give me the name of the detainee?" "Sarah Stunder," Manfred said. "Her address is 16 Akerlaan, Stellenbosch. If the arresting officers cannot find her there, she should be on platform 4 of the Cape Town railway station at 5:30 p.m. this afternoon. The woman must speak to no one before she is arrested. Your men must make certain of that." As Manfred hung up, he smiled grimly. Under the law, he had the power to arrest and detain any persons for 90 days, and to hold that person completely incommunicado. A great deal could happen in 90 days. Things could change. A person might even die. It was all taken care of. The woman could cause no further trouble. The telephone on his desk rang, and Manfred snatched it up, expecting it to be Bester again.
"Yes, what is it?"
"Pa, it's me, Lothie."
"Yes, Lothie, where are you?"
Caledon Square. I landed 20 minutes ago. And I've taken over the investigation. There's news, Pa. The divers have found the ferry. There's no sign of the prisoner's body, but the cabin door was forced open. We must assume that he escaped. Worse than that, somebody engineered his escape. Find him, Manfred said softly. You must find Moses Gama. If we don't, the consequences could be disastrous. I know, Lothar said. We will find him. We have to find him. Santon refused to eat the food in the parliamentary dining room.
It's not that I am fussy, chérie. In the desert, I ate live locusts and meat that had lain 4 days in the sun.
She and Charles walked down through the gardens, across the top end of town, to the Café Royal on Greenmarket Square, where the first oysters of the season had arrived from Neisner Lagoon. Santon sprinkled lemon juice and Tabasco sauce, scooped a gentle, pulsating mouthful from the half-shell, and sighed with pleasure.
And now, chérie, she dabbed the juice from her lips, tell me why you are so far away that you do not laugh at even my best efforts.
I'm sorry, mater, Charza signaled to the waiter to top up his champagne glass. I had a strange phone call this morning, and I haven't been able to concentrate on anything else. Do you remember White Sword?
How can you ask?
Santon laid down her fork. Sir Garry was more dear to me than my own father. Tell me all about it. They spoke of nothing else for the rest of the lunch, exploring together ancient memories of that terrible day on which a noble and generous man had died, a man who had been precious to them both. At last, Charza called for the bill.
It's 1:30 already. We'll have to hurry to reach the house before it begins. I don't want to miss any part of Favut's speech.
At 66 years of age, Santon was still active and agile, and Charza was not forced to moderate his stride for her. They were still talking animatedly as they passed St. George's Cathedral and turned into the gardens. Ahead of them, two men sat on one of the park benches, and there was something about them that caught Charza's attention, even at a distance of 100 yards. The taller of the pair was a swarthy-complexioned man who wore the uniform of a parliamentary messenger. He sat very stiffly upright and stared straight ahead of him with a fixed expression. The man beside him was also dark-haired, but his face was colourless as putty. The dead black hair fell forward onto his forehead. He was leaning close to the parliamentary messenger, speaking into his ear as though imparting a secret. But the messenger's face was expressionless, and he showed not the least reaction to the other man's words. As they came level with the bench, Charza leaned forward to see past Santon, and at less than 5 paces looked directly into the pale face of the smaller of the men. His eyes were black and implacable as pools of liquid tar. But as Charza studied him, the man deliberately turned his face away. Yet his lips kept moving, talking so softly to the man in the parliamentary uniform that Charza could not catch even a murmur of his voice. Santon tugged at his sleeve.
"Chérie, you are not listening to me."
"I'm sorry, mater," Charza apologized absent-mindedly.
"I wonder why this woman chose the railway station," Santon repeated.
"I suppose she feels safer in a public place," Charza hazarded, and glanced back over his shoulder.
The two men were still on the bench, but even in his preoccupation with other things, the passionless malevolence that Charza had seen in that tar-black gaze made him shiver, as though an icy wind had blown upon the back of his neck. As they turned into the lane that led to the massive edifice of Parliament, Charza felt suddenly confused and uncertain. There was too much happening all around him, over which he had no control. It was a sensation to which he was not accustomed. Joe Cicero whispered the formula softly.
"You can feel the worm in your belly."
"Yes," the man beside him replied, staring straight ahead. Only his lips moved as he made the reply. "I can feel the worm."
"The worm asks if you have the knife."
"Yes, I have the knife," said the man.
His father had been a Greek, and he had been born illegitimate in Portuguese Mozambique of a mulatto woman. His mixed blood was not apparent. It seemed merely as though he was of Mediterranean extraction. Only Europeans were employed as messengers in the South African Parliament.
You can feel the worm in your belly, Joe Cicero reinforced the man's conditioning. Yes, I can feel the worm.
8 times in the past few years, he had been in mental institutions. It was while he was in the last of these that he had been selected and the conditioning of his mind accomplished.
The worm asks if you know where to find the devil, Joe Cicero told him.
The man's name was Demetrios Tsafendas, and he had been introduced into South Africa the previous year, once his conditioning was completed.
Yes, said Tsafendas. I know where to find the devil.
The worm in your belly orders you to go straight to where the devil is, Joe Cicero said softly.
The worm in your belly orders you to kill the devil.
Tsafendas stood up.
He moved like an automaton.
The worm orders you to go.
Now.
Tsafendas started towards the Parliament building with an even, unhurried tread.
Joe Cicero watched him go.
It was done. All the pieces had been placed with great care. At last, the great boulder had started to roll down the hillside. It would gather others as it built up speed and momentum. Soon it would be a mighty avalanche, and the shape of the mountain would be changed forever. Joe Cicero stood up and walked away.
The first person Shaza saw as he and Santon walked up the front steps to the Parliament entrance was Kitty Godolphin, and his heart surged with excitement and unexpected pleasure. He hadn't seen her since that illicit interlude in the south of France 18 months before. Shaza had chartered a luxury yacht, and they had cruised as far as Capri. When they parted, she had promised to write, but she never kept her promises. And here she was again with no warning, smiling that sweet girlish smile with the devilment in her eyes, coming to greet him as innocently and naturally as though their last kiss had been hours before.
"What are you doing here?" he demanded without any preliminaries, and Kitty said to Santon, "Hello, Mrs. Courtney. How did such a nice cultured lady ever end up with such an ill-mannered son?"
Santon laughed. She liked Kitty. Shaza thought that it was a case of kindred spirits.
Kitty explained, "Oh, I was in Rhodesia to get a profile on Ian Smithy before he meets Harold Wilson, and I made a side trip for the speech that Favour is giving today, and, of course, to visit with you."
They chatted for a few minutes. Then Santon excused herself.
"I must get a good seat in the gallery."
As she moved away, Shaza asked Kitty softly,
"When can I see you?"
"This evening?" Kitty suggested.
"Yes. Oh, no, damn it."
He remembered his rendezvous with the White Sword informer.
"Where are you staying?"
"The Nelly, as usual."
"Can I call you there later?"
"Sure," she smiled.
"Unless I get any better offers."
"You little bitch. Why don't you marry me?"
"I'm too good for you, Buster."
It had become one of their stock jokes. "But I don't mind an order of small beer and chips on the side.
See you later."
Shaza watched her climb the staircase towards the press gallery. Over all the years he had known her, she seemed not to have aged a day. She still had the body of a girl, and the light spring of youth in her step. He pushed back the sudden cold gloom of loneliness that threatened to engulf him, and walked into the chamber. The benches were filling. Shaza saw that the Prime Minister was in his seat at the head of the government benches. He was talking to Frank Waring, the Minister of Sport, and the only other Englishman in the cabinet. Favour looked fit and vigorous. It seemed impossible that he had taken 2 revolver bullets through his skull and had come back with such power to dominate his own party and the entire chamber this way. He seemed to have an infinite capacity for survival, and, of course, Shaza grinned cynically, the luck of the devil himself. Shaza turned towards his own seat, and Manfred de la Rey jumped up and came to intercept him. He seized Shaza's arm and leaned close to him.
"The divers have raised the ferry. Gama's body is not in it, and the door to the cabin has been forced.
It looks as though the bastard has got clean away. But we have every exit from the country guarded, and my men will get him. He cannot get away. I think the Prime Minister is going to make the announcement of his disappearance during his speech this afternoon. Shaza and Manfred began walking towards their seats on the front bench, when somebody bumped so roughly against Shaza that he exclaimed and glanced around. It was the uniformed messenger that Shaza had noticed on the park bench. "Be careful, fellow," Shaza snapped at him as he recovered his balance. But the man did not seem to hear. Although his expression was vacant and his eyes staring and unseeing, the messenger walked with a quick, determined step, brushing past Manfred and heading towards the opposition benches on the left side of the speaker's throne. "Damned rude," Shaza said, pausing to watch him. Suddenly, the messenger seemed to change his mind. He veered across the chamber and hurried towards where Dr. Favut was sitting. The Prime Minister saw him coming and looked up expectantly, supposing that the man had a message for him. Nobody else in the chamber seemed to be taking any notice of the messenger's erratic behaviour, but Shaza was watching with puzzlement. As the messenger stood over Dr. Favut, he swept his dark uniform jacket open, and Shaza saw the silver flash of steel. "Good Christ!" he exclaimed. "He's got a knife!" The messenger lifted the blade and struck once, and strangely the Prime Minister was smiling, as though he did not realise what was happening. The blade came free, and the silver was misted pink with blood. Shaza started forward, but Manfred still had hold of his arm. "The Manchurian candidate," he hissed, and Shaza froze. Standing over the Prime Minister, the assassin struck again, and then again. With each blow, the blood spurted down his white shirt front, and Dr. Favut lifted his hands in a pathetic gesture of appeal. At last, the men closest to him realized what was happening, and they leapt upon the assailant. A knot of struggling men swarmed over him, but the man was fighting back with a kind of demonic strength. "Where is the devil?" he shouted wildly. "I'll get the devil!" They bore him to the green carpet and pinned him there. Dr. Favut still sat in his seat, staring down at his own chest, from which the bright blood poured. Then he pulled the lapels of his jacket closed, as though to hide the terrible sight of his own blood, and with a sigh slid forward and crumpled onto the carpeted floor of the chamber. Shaza and Manfred de la Rey were in Shaza's parliamentary office when Tricia brought the news through. "Gentlemen, the party whip has just telephoned. Dr. Favut has been declared dead on arrival at the Folks Hospital." Shaza went to the liquor cabinet behind his desk and poured two glasses of cognac. They watched each other's eyes as they drank silently, and then Shaza lowered his glass and said, "We must start at once to draw up a list of those we can rely on to support you. I think John Forster is the man you will have to beat for the premiership, and his people will already be busy." They worked together through the afternoon preparing their lists, placing ticks and crosses and queries against the names, telephoning, wheedling and extorting, arranging meetings, making promises and commitments, trading and compromising, and as the afternoon wore on, a stream of important visitors, allies and potential allies passed through Shaza's suite. While they worked, Shaza watched Manfred and wondered again how fate had chosen such strange travelling companions as they were. It seemed that they had nothing in common except that one vital trait, burning, unrelenting ambition and hunger for power. Well, it was at their fingertips now, almost within their grasp, and Manfred was a man possessed. The effect of his enormous force of character was apparent on the men who came up to Shaza's office suite. One by one they were swept along by it, and one by one they swore their allegiance to him. Slowly it dawned upon Shaza that it was no longer a possibility, or even a probability. They were going to win. He knew in his guts and his heart it was theirs, the premiership and the presidency between them. They were going to win. In the heady excitement of it all, the afternoon passed swiftly. The grandfather clock in the corner of Shaza's office chimed the hours softly,
such a familiar sound that he hardly noticed it until it struck five, and he started and jumped to his feet, confirming the time with his wristwatch. "Oh, it's 5 o'clock." He started towards the door.
"Where are you going? I need you here,"
Manfred called after him.
"Come back, Shaza."
"I'll be back," Shaza answered, and ran into the outer office. There were men waiting there, important men. They stood up to greet him, and Tricia called,
"Mr. Courtney?"
"Not now," Shaza ran past them. "I'll be back soon." He realized that the woman informer was so nervous and afraid that she would probably not linger at the rendezvous. He had to get there before the appointed time. As he ran, he reviled himself for having forgotten such an important appointment. But it was all confusion and uncertainty. He raced down the sidewalk, crowded with office workers, relieved of the tedium of their day, who poured out of the buildings. Shaza pushed and shoved and weaved and ducked. Some of those he barged into shouted angrily after him. He sprinted through the columns of slowly moving vehicles and ran into the Adderley Street entrance of the railway station. The clock above the main concourse stood at 5:37. He was already late, and Platform 4 was at the far end of the building. Wildly, he raced down the concourse and barged onto the quay. He slowed to a hurried walk and made his way down the platform, examining the faces of the commuters waiting there. They stared back at him incuriously, and he glanced up at the platform clock. 5:45. 10 minutes late, she had come and gone. He had missed her.